It's time for Eco Talk with host Betsy Rosenberg.
She'll be great. She's a very smart, capable person who knows exactly what took place and will lay out the facts. And that's what the American people want to see.
I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich.
Welcome to a special edition of Eco Talk, special for a couple of reasons. One, we're taping this program in San Francisco in the New York studios at Air America. I'll tell you why we happen to be here in just a few minutes. Also special because this program will be airing on the 36th anniversary celebration of the original Earth Day back in 1970, an appropriate time to reflect on what's been accomplished and what needs to happen still, lots as you can imagine. And of course, topic one on the environmental agenda is global warming, a subject with so many angles and aspects that we try to bring you some part of, at least if not every week, every couple of weeks. So the first half of today's show, we'll be chatting with Andrew Revkin. He's a prize-winning reporter for the New York Times. I hope you all see his stories. They're very important and been seeing a lot more lately, especially on this topic. And he's been covering the environmental beat since 1995. Also, Andrew is a great songwriter and singer. You can hear his music as I speak. And he's going to be talking to us about his new book called The North Pole Was Here, Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World. He's going to be joining us in studio in just a minute. In the second half, we'll be meeting with the Green Gals from ABC Home Furnishings. That's a large retailer store centered on the East Coast, and they've taken a decidedly green turn. We're going to find out what that's about, how it's being received, and we'll let you know where you can buy some green furnishings if you happen to be in the New York metropolitan area. Our first guest, as I said, is Andrew Revkin. Great to see you in person. We've had you on the show before on the phone. And congratulations on your third book.
That's right, yeah. First one that I've written that's for the whole family, basically.
So I can have my 11-year-old daughter read it with me?
Yeah, for sure. At least that's my hope.
Will it scare her and give her nightmares, or just me?
No, see, the book, I think there's been too much sort of scary coverage of climate lately. We are clearly influencing the planet in ways that are going to have a lot of impacts. And if it's portrayed all the time as some huge, alarming transformation, it kind of disempowers people to some extent. And so with this book, what I've tried to do is pull back and just talk about the part of the world where there's been the most change of late, the Arctic, and just say it's transforming. Basically, the Arctic that we grew up with in our history and our lore is this sort of frozen, distant place is becoming, later this century, probably an open ocean for the first time in human history, and possibly for the first time in like 130,000 years. So that's a big deal, just that.
When you think of that part of the world, you think of solid ice, and yeah, it's not so solid anymore. It's melting.
Yeah, well, the world has two poles. They're very different. The one at the bottom, the South Pole, is a continent coated with ice, and it's a place where you can go easily to do science. It's harsh, but there you can have your doctors there, your cooks, this permanent buildings. The North Pole is an ocean, and we kind of forget that because it's always cloaked behind that ice, and now that ice is starting to, every summer it's going away a bit more, and there's still some questions about how fast that could persist, but it's hard to find scientists these days who don't see a human hand in some of the change that's already underway in the Arctic.
You traveled up there to do this book. What was that like?
I've been to the Arctic three times in the last 3 years to report on the science and implications of these changes. For this book, I went to the place, you can't go any farther north than the North Pole. When you're there, all is south, as I say in the book. And it's a profound experience to fly in a 15-ton airplane over a frozen ocean, land on ice that's just 6 or 8 feet thick. And it's basically beneath that is 14,000 vertical feet of ocean. It just feels like it shouldn't be physically possible to land a heavy airplane on floating ice, but we did.
Uh-huh. And it's floating and maybe breaking apart, not overnight, but we're hearing that there's change underway. What does that feel like and sound like? You actually experienced the sound of ice cracking.
Well, the ice there, it shrinks in the summer when you have a six-month day in the Arctic. The sun rises in March and sets in September, and that's it. And so through that 24-hour daylight through that summer, it gets quite – the surface gets warm, and you get a lot of melting. And that's what's happened more and more lately. So the Arctic ice cap at the North Pole has been shrinking. But the ice itself, we think of the ice cap up there. You look at a map, and it looks like just this white surface. But it's actually more like giant Scrabble tiles that are all bumping up against each other, floating on the ocean. And when they bump up against each other and you're standing on them, they make the most unearthly sounds. I was with a scientist named Tim Stanton near the North Pole ice camp And suddenly the ice beneath our feet was vibrating, and you could look at the open water areas, and the water was kind of jiggling like in that scene in
Jurassic Park,
where you can hear the T-Rex coming, and the puddles vibrating. It's like that. And so everything's – and then suddenly the sound starts, and it was unearthly, and he kind of started to explain what was going on.
You can feel the chunk that we're on actually starting to fail a bit more, probably hairline cracks up the towards the helos there.
So does that mean we should back up?
Not yet. You could always jump over a crack. The power is just, it's unstoppable. There's no mechanical system you could really design to live through a thing like this. The forces are just stunning. And that's the risk. That's the risk we take.
What are the people who work up there like? And are they aware of this shift? I would think more aware than anybody.
Well, scientists have been trying to get to the center of the Arctic Ocean for a while because we know a ton about global warming. The basic facts are undisputed now, even by some longtime skeptics. Everyone agrees now that there is a human influence on climate and that it's a warming influence. The more we add of these gases to the air, the trap heat, the warmer it'll get in the future.
And we now know it's official because Time Magazine has done a cover story and Vanity Fair now on the threat greater than terrorism. So it's really reaching the mainstream. You've been covering it in the New York Times. But, of course, the people who have been doing the science, people who live and work up there, have been aware of this for some time.
Yeah, and since 2000, they've been trying to establish it annually. Right now, in April, is when it happens. These scientists are up there, as we speak, on the sea ice, dropping instruments through into the ocean and trying to test conditions, temperature changes in salinity. They all give you a picture of – you have to do it year by year, though, to get a sense of trend. And no one has done that before. The Arctic has got big gaps in our understanding, and so they're trying to fill them. And the people who do this are borderline insane, actually. They're obsessive. You know, all scientists are wonderful. One of the things I've been trying to portray in this book, especially because it's aimed partially at younger readers, is to re-enchant us with science itself and to also appreciate the value of the knowledge that is gleaned that way. Once an idea is tested, and it's been around a while, and this idea of a human influence on the climate system has been around now 100 years, and the science building toward that conclusion has been a steady trajectory. So any thoughts about there being skepticism about that or ancient history? The questions and the legitimate debate is about how do you respond? So these people have been going up there, and they're willing to endure ridiculous conditions, 20 degrees below zero temperatures, shifting, cracking ice underneath your tent for weeks at a time. I was there for 3 days and felt exhausted and at the end of that 3 days. So to do it for several weeks is
amazing. Did you have to get in condition to just prepare to be in that kind of climate?
No, I had to buy a lot of clothes that
layer,
I didn't own.
Layer.
I always kind of, I was more oriented toward the tropics most of my life. And for me, it was not natural to look north, but that's where the change is. And so as a journalist, that's where you go.
And you mentioned before we started that you actually wrote a book on the tropics. You started there in terms of your investigative journalistic environmental expedition and moved up to the North Pole. So what happened in between there?
Well, it's interesting because global warming came of age in the late 1980s, right when the Amazon was burning. So the first big burst of media coverage of climate change happened largely associated with the tropics because of the burning of the Amazon. And I wrote a book about the murder of Chico Mendez, the Amazon activist who sort of led a homegrown movement to stop the cutting. The burning season just recently came out again, which is nice. But the story kind of migrated northward because lately the changes that have been most noticeable to scientists have been in the Arctic and increasingly a little bit in Antarctica as well. So as a journalist, you go where the news is. And there's some disturbing trends underway. And again, it's clear we're headed toward a world that will be a very different place than the one we sort of grew up with.
Disturbing trends indeed. And yet it seems like America's still kind of asleep on this. You think it's just beginning to penetrate mainstream consciousness, or has it already, we're just so good at denying, you know, things we don't want to deal with?
Well, you hit on a good point there. It's not just things we don't want to deal with, but things that are longer term or that are complicated, we shy away from, not just Americans, but everyone. People are not quick to act now on the basis of a future risk, and that makes it a challenging thing. It's like Social Security and the national debt. They creep and they build, and we sort of say, well, we'll get at it.
It's sort of like, well, what's the ideal degree of crisis? What do we need to really force a tipping point? you know, when it seems too far off and abstract and not relevant to our lives, worry about that later. Yeah. And then it can also, it seems like it's very quickly shifting to, oh my God, life as we know it may be changing and it's later than we think. And then people can go into paralysis and kind of, you know, feel like there's nothing we can do and get kind of laissez-faire about it or complacent or something like that.
The main thing in the book is just to get familiar with the underpinnings of what we know. And then people can get engaged and look at it with your kids and to understand together that our actions today are influencing their future. That's the thing that might drive some change.
Absolutely. We're going to continue our conversation with Andrew Revkin, New York Times environmental correspondent, and talking about his new book called The North Pole Was Here. We will be right back.